Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
What does VA mean to me?
A place for my daughter to call home. Thanks to the VA home loan.
A new lease on life. The best healthcare team I've ever had is here at VA.
And education and the opportunity to open doors I never thought possible with my GI Bill.
The financial support I need to manage the disabilities I develop because of my service.
Get what you earn. Visit choose.va.gov.
Not all veterans are eligible for the type or amount of benefits mentioned here.
All right. Welcome back to another episode of the Lookout Podcast. I'm joined by the legend of Lookouts himself, Leif Haugen. Thank you for joining me, man. I appreciate you.
You bet.
How's the volume now? Did I come off a little hot?
No, that's good.
All right. So you've been Lookout for how long now?
Since 1994. So this past season, I guess, would be my 32nd season.
Dang, that's a long run, my friend.
Oh, yeah.
What brought you there in the first place?
Well, I was always interested in them and, you know, grew up reading, you know, some Lookout legends like Ed Abbey, and when I was in college in Missoula as a young man, made a friend who was a Forest Service employee, and she was getting her degree as a, you know, through the Forest Service and was in college doing that. And one day I asked if they were still staffing Lookouts, and she gave me a real funny look and thought, well, yeah, but, you know, I could see you being one. And so she showed up the next day with some phone numbers and said, if you're serious about it, you know, call these people and I'll support you. And a couple weeks later, I had my first Lookout job.
Oh, man.
Seal Lake Ranger District, 1994.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Did you have any coaching on, like, you know, the solidarity of it, like a little heads up? Like,
no, really no coaching at all. I mean, I showed up at the district with a backpack thinking I was going up there that day, and I didn't know the whole culture of a week orientation, a week of fire school. But that was part of the fun too, in the introduction to both the agency and how things work.
Yeah.
And it was a neat Lookout in the sense that it's staffed by the state and the Forest Service. So there's a state Lookout and a Forest Service Lookout, and you split time.
Oh.
And so he was a longtime Lookout, and he's the one who trained me up. And then when I wasn't busy at that Lookout because he was there, I would fill in, like, at Blue Mountain for Gene Miller. I filled in for him a couple times because 94 was a really busy summer.
Oh, yeah.
So I ended up getting a lot more Lookout time than I thought. And in the end, I ended up taking that Lookout over because the state Lookout was a pretty busy guy when he wasn't doing that. And it was so busy in 94 that he just kind of checked out, and I took it on. And that was a great summer. Yeah. But it also wasn't the perfect Lookout, and said it wasn't mine. So it never really felt. And so the next season, I applied all over the place trying to find the right spot.
Yeah.
And that, I guess that kind of started my journey with Lookouts. And I've been in the Flathead Glacier region since 98. So I've always been up the North Fork, whether it was for the Park Service or the Forest Service, since 1998.
Dang, man. Yeah, that's a good run and a beautiful spot to be.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And Blue Mountain, that's not the same Blue Mountain outside of Missoula,
oh, yeah.
Is it?
Yep.
That's the one?
Yeah.
Right by the observatory?
You bet.
Oh.
Yeah, so I spent, you know, probably like two or three-day stretches there that summer in 94 because it was so busy that we were staffing Lookouts, you know, 7 days a week, 12 hours a day kind of thing. And Gene needed time off as well.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I felt like I filled in another Lookout that summer, but it's I'm not.
It's not ringing a bell, right?
Yeah.
Dang, man, that's cool, because that Blue Mountain one, I always forget how tall it is until you drive up there. You're like, that's on some tall stilts.
It is. You know? It is, yeah. It's too bad to not see it, you know, still in use, but
yeah.
I think that's what you see a lot these days with Lookouts. The ones that, you know, are kind of, the ones that are really remote are the ones that seem to be holding steady, and the ones like that one, there's just so much activity up there already, and so many other places to kind of
monitor
the town, you know, that urban interface area. And then what was cool is Gene ended up, we have a volunteer program up here that I administer. And so, when they shut Blue Mountain down, he started volunteering up here.
Oh, cool.
At Cooney Lookout, for us, and he grew up in the Swan.
Oh, yeah.
So for him, it was kind of like coming home and looking out over the Swan Valley, which was, really neat. And he also got 50 years in at Lookouts.
Oh, he did? Jeez,
yeah,
man.
Yeah.
That's a good run. Holy cow, man.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And so valuable, man. Like, you know, one of the things I want to touch on too is that there, you know, always the idea kicking around of like automated lookouts. Yeah. It's just not the same, you know?
No.
And I don't think it ever will be. I don't think, in my opinion, at least, I don't care how good the technology gets, having a human like yourself up there is invaluable. Because not only, you know, Sam just like crew lead for a trails crew, and I'm up in the middle of nowhere, no fire risk, but at least I got someone who's up high who can see the weather, who I am confident is aware, because I'd check in with you, that I'm down there for any kind of concern, like whether or like someone gets a bee sting and I can't get out to dispatch or anything because I'm in a hole. Yeah, I relay to you. You know, get the ball rolling, and it's just there's a safety factor beyond fire that people don't, I think, really realize.
Absolutely. Yep. And then you're there 24 hours a day. You know, not 7 days a week, because we do work 10 on, 4 off when things are slow and the fire danger is low. But the way, especially like here, the way we do our coverage is we scatter people's days off. So like up in the North Fork where I'm at, there's always 2 or 3 lookouts up. Of the 4 lookouts that are staffed, so we make sure we kind of continue our coverage, even in low fire danger, just for those kind of situations.
Yeah. Well, which is awesome.
Yeah,
like anything could come up, you know, and just having someone there to support you a little bit. And it's not like it's costing a ton of money to staff a lookout, you know.
It's very reasonable, especially in terms of what our budget is, both for the district and or our fire office.
Yeah.
I mean, the maintenance part of it can be costly, but just the summer wage for a lookout is, you know, we're talking somewhere between a GS3 and a GS5 for anywhere from 3 to 5 months. It's not a huge part of the budget.
Yeah, that's, and for folks who are unfamiliar with the GS wage, those 3 and 5s are entry wages in the Forest Service, so lower wages.
Mm-hmm.
And to get folks who are as good as you or any of the lookouts that I've ran into that you know, are doing it more for the money, more than the money. I mean, the value is way more than that of the GS5.
Yeah.
You know, the bang you're getting for your buck is astronomical compared to, you know, what the physician is getting paid, you know.
And like you said, I mean, that to me, that's been a big point of pride, is the kind of the safety aspect we provide just for all the employees and even the public that's out there recreating too, just being a point of contact, especially now with cell phones. I mean, a lot of people thought cell phones would make it make us less useful, but it's just we have more contact and more ability to reach out. Both in support the fire office and or when a situation comes up. I mean,
search and rescue, right?
Yep. Yeah. Somebody's running late, their radio's dead, you know, or they can't get out on the radio. They can get a hold of me. I can call the office or their spouse even.
Yeah.
I've had a few emergencies overnight, in the middle of the night, where I can make a call and get people heading toward somebody that needs help. So.
Yeah. Totally. That's huge. And then like for, you know, having a search area for somebody, like you said, if you're the last point of contact, like, I saw them go by, you know, I saw the truck leave. So they're like, they're not in this area. We know that now.
Yeah.
You know, like that's huge.
And I've even redirected alert the medical helicopter, because they were flying over my lookout and on the radio, I could hear the situation was 20 miles away, but their coordinates were bad.
Yeah.
So I got on the radio and said, hey, you know, you're 20 miles off if you're responding to this incident. And they went, oh, dang. And they said, are you sure? And I, yeah, you know, I can hear it on the radio. So I looked at the map and gave them new coordinates and got them headed the right direction.
That's awesome.
The woman whose dad was injured ended up sending me a thank you note because she had heard that they weren't in the right spot and they got redirected, which was pretty sweet.
Yeah. Man. Oh, yeah. That feels good, man. And like those things, right? Like you saved them valuable time with them, you know, chasing their tail in the wrong spot, you know, and all parties appreciate that. Oh, man. There's so many layers to it, dude. I think the surface value of everything in the world, right? Not just forest service related or fire, but, you know, like if you just look at surface value, sometimes you're not seeing the real value of it, you know, or just that story alone is, you know, more valuable than what people think of just someone in the tower just looking for smokes, you know? Which is also valuable in itself, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Like that's the, you know, the main purpose up there is finding fires. But, and so you went, did you go right to, is it, man, I'm going to mess this up. What's the lookout tower you're in now?
I'm at Toma.
Toma, yeah.
So basically my lineup, I guess, was I was Mount Morrell on Sealy Lake in 94, and then I moved to the Kootenai National Forest and was Keeler Mountain lookout and mostly Mount Henry from 95 to 97 there. And Mount Henry was wonderful, but I wasn't, my wife was working on the east side of the mountains, and it was hard to see each other. And so she got a job in Glacier, and that's when I moved to.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously, your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Numa Ridge in Glacier. So I was at Numa Ridge.
In Glacier Park?
In Glacier Park, 1998 to 2009.
Whoa, dude.
And then the forest was interested in restoring, rehabbing the Toma lookout because it had been abandoned for 37 years. Some locals had kind of looked after a little bit, but it needed a lot of work. And because I did a lot of assessments for building, for restoration work, I went up there and basically gave them an option. You know, you could either just stabilize it or you could get it to staffing condition. And then I gave them the numbers on that. And they said, well, shoot, with that, why wouldn't we staff it? And I said, well, if you staff it, I'd move over there.
Yeah.
And so that's when I switched over to the Tunghurst Glacier View District in Toma.
Oh, awesome, man. Dude, you, man, like that, you know, I've already heard a lot about you, so I was already, like, really excited to meet you. But then there's so many layers. I mean, like, is there even a lookout in Glacier? Is there one left?
Oh, yeah. No, they staff four.
Oh, they do. I heard was one left. And
nope.
Oh, gotcha.
No, so they staff four, and it was actually up to five for a little bit when I was there.
Awesome.
That was a unique situation where we had one volunteer who that allowed us to make it five. But when he quit doing it, we dropped back to four. And they've, this year they were three and a half because the fourth lookout that they tried to hire bailed at the last minute. Year to year they're looking to staff four lookouts.
That is great to hear.
Yeah,
because it's such a cool spot, and like some of those lookouts up there, like they're so unique and cool looking.
Yeah.
There's like that one, it's built out of stone mostly. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Swift Current. Yep. And then there's Heaven's Peak lookout too, which is even more unique, but there's no trail. It's really challenging to get to, so not a lot of people see that. But Swift Current's the kind of the iconic one. And I mean, what's neat about Swift Current is it was intentionally built that way because it was, you could see it from Granite Park Chalet and the Many Glacier Hotel, and it was kind of up on the high spot between those two locations. So they wanted to mirror some of the rock work And it is a beautiful lookout.
Is it big? Is it normal size? Like
normal
size lookout.
Normal size lookout.
Yeah, some of the photos make it look a little bigger, a little more grandiose.
Especially when it's the stone. I think helps with that. I mean, the same thing as St. Mary Peak down by you guys. I don't know why when I go there, just that rock base makes it seem just a little more sizable, maybe. But
yeah. Well, great photo op. I mean, like my. I think it's the Instagram homepage is St. Mary's.
Oh yeah,
because you know the pan is just great from the top of the Bitterroots, and then like you said that stone base, it makes it look a little more grand for sure.
Yeah,
man. And then Heaven's Peak is it stone built as well?
Yeah, yeah. And all these lookouts in the park have undergone pretty serious restoration work by the Park Service and their historic preservation crew there.
Very cool.
And so. Heaven's Peak as well, even it involved a lot of flight time, but they got it, they did restore it, and the rock work is pretty impressive on that one.
That's so cool, man. And oh man, what a cool job to be able to restore, because you've helped out on ton of those projects too, right? Restoring lookouts.
Well, yeah, and so I'm a carpenter when I'm not a fire lookout, so that's my profession. I always tell people I'm a fire lookout, but 6-7 months of the year, I'm wearing the tool bags.
Yeah. Slamming hammers. Or slamming nails, sorry.
Yep. And so when I was with the park, I would do some, but because they had the preservation crew, they didn't need as much help. And then, but when I moved to the Forest Service, basically I took on restoring Toma, which was looking at staffing. And that kind of snowballed into basically doing rehabbing all the lookouts on the district.
Oh, wow.
Over 4, 5, 6 years. And so, we did some pretty serious restoration work on Baptiste, on Coleridge Cabin, which is actually a lookout structure from 1928, but it's just it's a little ground cabin. And then just tuned up a, firefighter, Hornet, Cyclone, a lot of work on all of those.
Hornet's like the one that everyone talks about.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's the oldest lookout in Region 1.
Oh, it is?
1922. There's a touch of debate on that, but it's the oldest standing one. I mean, Grave Peak, which is one I've worked on a bunch as well, on the Powell District, over on the Clearnez.
Oh, yeah.
Is similarly aged.
Similar design, too? Like the Grange,
cupola. Yep, yeah. The cupola, and that also is a rare style to see anymore.
Yeah.
Where Hornet's unique is the log base, and that's part of the. It's a little harder to maintain that too, and the historic preservation team out of Missoula did some work on the sill logs there fall too. So
nice, Mr. Jack Poppin, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, he's the man.
It's a collab. I mean, and that's what's so neat is the collaboration that it takes to keep these up and running.
Yeah, Sydney Bacon too, right?
Oh, yeah.
She does a lot. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's great too. Because she, I watched her presentation on the one I think you helped a lot. Is it the Powell one with the logs?
Well, there's the Bear Mountain. They're working on the log structure at the base of that right now. And then I re-roofed and new shutters and a whole bunch of work on the lookout portion of Bear Mountain. Probably 5, 6, 7 years ago.
Oh, gotcha. Is that the one they had to helicopter a bunch of logs in to rebuild the base? Or am I thinking of a different one?
That would be my guess. Oh, I haven't been a part of the log cabin restoration there.
Oh, gotcha.
By the time, basically, we started with the lookout, got that fully tuned, and then I stepped away, and I think Jack and Kathy have done that with some help from Nate Raff and some other people too. So,
oh gosh, yeah, I'm thinking a different one because it was Kyle and Sydney did a presentation at the Forest Fire Lookout Association two years ago.
Yep. Oh, the one in St. Regis.
Yeah.
And that I think might have been Big Hole.
Oh, maybe is that the lookout they were working on? Yeah, it was really cool. Just seeing that I was able to get restored, and a lot of volunteer hours. And
and there was also Skookum.
Skookum. Yeah, that's what it was. Skookum. I'm almost positive it's Skookum.
And what's weird to me is...
Did you help on that one?
Nope.
Oh, for some reason I thought you were involved.
What's weird for me is I have a connection to the Clearnez.
Yeah.
And so basically I got tied into helping them. And with my duties staffing a look... I mean, what's great is my office here, they let me make my own schedule. They realize that I have an interest in this. So they kind of let me... As long as I'm at my lookout from July 1st through, you know, mid to late September. I can play it however I want.
Awesome.
And so I got tied in with the Clearwater Nez National Forest, you know, helping them with a bunch of their lookouts. So, and I can only take on one or two, you know, like usually I do one or two assessments a year and maybe take on one or two a season. And usually it's before or after that, you know, the staffing season.
Yeah, so not a big window to work with.
No, it oftentimes, I've had it before where I left my lookout on September 30th because the snow was coming. And I got home, spent a night at home, started driving, got to a lookout 18 miles in on the Nez in the Selway, and it was snowing there too, and the crew was there, and we couldn't get any work done because it just, the season ended. Yeah. I mean, right there, it snowed on us for 3-4 days, and we realized it wasn't going to dry out enough to get work done.
Yeah.
But, and that's part of it. You know, we do our best, and there's times, or there's been times too where I've had one on the list and I'm too busy with fire to leave and go work on it. But
man,
you just take your opportunity.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I think it's a good practice in patience too, yep. Right? Yep. Like, well, you know, it's on the list. We're going to get to it when we can. And you can only do what you can because of Mother Nature.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. And then, so the one you're in right now, Toma. Mm-hmm. Toma?
Yep.
Is Grange style? Is that what?
No. So it's a L4 prototype.
Oh.
So it was the original L4. So it meaning it has a gable roof, not a hip roof. And the problem with the prototype is the windows were a little too short.
Oh, so you're standing up here.
So if I sit in the middle of the room in a regular chair, I really can't see the country I'm surveying. So everything in my lookout is just a little bit, all my chairs and counters and tables and desks are a little taller.
Oh, really?
To make sure that I, you know, can always see what I need to see. And obviously the majority of the observation happens outside anyways, but I am on the ground, and so I don't have a catwalk either.
Yeah.
But you know, you're outside anyway, a lot of the time is where you're really doing your observing. But, I mean, shoot, I woke up first thing in the morning and opened my eyes and had a smoke, you know, 10 miles away. You know, and that's why you need to be sleeping at window level.
Yeah.
So when you wake up, you can see what you need to see.
Survey the land a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. For folks who are unfamiliar with Leaf, he has two videos on YouTube that are excellent. One's like a shorter 2-minute, and it's got like a rocket on the side. I wish I could describe it more, but
Great Big Story is.
Is that the one?
That's what the program is called, or they do all these shorts.
Yeah.
I guess. Yeah.
And that one's a really good short because.
Yeah.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
You know, if you're in a hurry, 2 minutes and it sums up nicely, not everything, of course, but it sums up the lookout life nicely, mm-hmm. especially yours. And then the other one is the Montana, the 20-minute one or so.
Yeah, so it was basically independent documentary filmmaker reached out to the Park Service, and it was the season I left the park and came here, and the park said, well, why don't you, you know, try this person, I guess, and directed them
to you,
to me, and really, I mean, so it's out there on a bunch of different venues like YouTube, and I think the Montana Film Office, you might get to it through there, but basically it was just an independent filmmaker who did it on his own and then put it on the short on like the Documentary Film Festival schedule, I guess, you know, where he traveled with it for a season.
Very cool.
And took it to 6-7 different film festivals to show it.
Yeah, and I really loved how you spoke in that one, because it's a little, you know, a lot more long form versus two minute, and you were able to get more of the kind of emotion into it and the day-to-day into it. And, like, I mean, even just the process of going to the spring and collecting water, and then you shorten it up earlier in the season.
Mm-hmm.
Like, very cool stuff that people who don't live out in the West probably have, wouldn't know about, you know?
Exactly, yeah. And and that's where the filmmaker, he got a lot of, he almost sometimes says it with chagrin that, you know, that's the one people want to talk to him about. And I think because it's a unique lifestyle, and I think he did a good job of portraying what it is like, and the quiet and the solitude. And I mean, a lot of times, really, you're just seeing the beauty and hearing the wind blow too. I mean, there's some pretty good silence in there. So
yeah, totally, man. And were you looking for that when you first got into the Lookout career, or was that just more of a benefit that you got from it?
You know, the solitude and the for sure. I mean, I've always enjoyed, I guess, I've lived a pretty solitary life. I mean, I've always enjoyed that part of it. You know, like if I go backpacking, a lot of times I like going by myself. And so the Lookout, really, what I love about it is the beauty. You know, first and foremost, is just to get paid to live in a spot like that and watch the weather, watch it develop, watch it change, watch what it does. And then, there's nothing like just sitting on the catwalk and watching the day go by. And the quiet involved with that too.
Yeah. Taking the life, the smells, the mountain air. Oh man, the plant life and the animal life around you.
Mm-hmm.
I could dig it for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Man. Yeah. What a great experience. And that's what I liked about some of the books we've read too, like in the book club with, you know, Cat and Billy with Smoke Chasers. There's not everybody can do it, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Like it's kind of rare. And of the people who have done it, like yourself, even there's only a handful of you guys that have done it ever in the history of Lookouts, because there have never been that many of them, and there's even less nowadays, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, very cool opportunity that you have up there.
Oh, yeah. Ed Abbey said, you either do it for 1 year, you do it for many years. And I think he's absolutely right in the sense that, you know, there's a lot of people who really think it would be a neat experience. And after a season, they say, oh, it was, but I don't want to do that again.
Yeah.
You know, and the people that it catches, oftentimes it sticks, you know, where we don't get we get a lot of people do it 1 year, or we get a lot of people to do it 5 to 50 years.
Yeah. It gets addictive, I think.
Yeah.
And like you said in that short film, Your Home Away From Home, you know, just,
oh, totally. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So like a downsized version of what you had at home.
Oh yeah. And really, you know, and I always say this to everybody is I have everything I need, you know, it's everything I have at home. It's just on a smaller scale.
Yeah.
And you know, my wife, she comes up, you know, a few times a year, she can come up anytime she wants. And, you know, she gets, you know, where she wants to come up. She just comes on up, spends the night, hangs out.
Yeah, it probably works out good. Yeah, I was gonna say it works out great for her too. Probably a little getaway. Man, and there's really not that many opportunities in the busy world and ever in life, because life's always been pretty busy in you know, recent years, modern times, to be able to check out almost completely. Not totally. I mean, you got your phone and the radio and stuff, but like away from the hustle and bustle, as you really can be and still be connected. You know.
Oh yeah, and I mean, I spent plenty of years without a cell phone and. I enjoyed that, and I probably sell it to my friends and family, you know, that I don't have as good a cell service as they think I do. But what I've learned more so is that when it comes to fire, having a phone really it helps, because there's times where having that conversation rather than over the radio or a satellite phone, just the communication on a sat phone isn't as easy as a cell phone.
100%.
So basically I think I had cell service show up at Toma like right around 2016, and FireWise, it's really been a benefit for sure, because you just to not have everything go over the radio, or through the satellite phone is a big benefit. And especially when I'm talking to British Columbia, because I can't talk to them on the radio. So everything happens on the phone with them.
I didn't think about that. We're that close to Canada up here.
Oh yeah.
You know,
I mean, my Lookout's 2.5 air miles from the international border. I mean, I can see the border cut
really
from the Lookout, and I've had plenty of fires in Canada, but mostly small initial attacks. And there was a fire, the Weasel Fire, gosh, 2021, 22, something like that, where it was on the Kootenai National Forest, the Flathead National Forest, and British Columbia.
Whoa.
And so I was talking to all three agencies, and then a team in Canada took over the fire. And so basically I was tied in with their fire behavior analysts and give them weather and daily updates. And what was nice is, you know, I'll never meet those people. I'll never see them again. But that fall when I came down, my district ranger came in to my office, said, "Boy, you know, Leaf, that was awesome. That, you know, British Columbia really talked, you know, about how much that support helped them out."
So, see, look at the Valley and the Lookouts, yeah. Man. Like those, yeah. that right there. Like, I mean, and I've been in fire for over 17 years, yeah. And like that's not a scenario that's ever run across my plate. So I wouldn't even think about it. Yeah. It's like, man, just that alone is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah,
man.
And like I said, I mean, what was neat for them is British Columbia, I think, has only a couple lookouts left. And so it was kind of a unique experience for them too, to see both the value and, you know, I wasn't giving them, you know, groundbreaking information, but I was giving them daily, you know, weather as it changed, you know, and also fire behavior reports, you know, based on what I could see the fire doing and where it was moving and how it was behaving. And
yeah, real time.
Yeah.
Yep. And then, which is huge, yeah. You know, like, yeah. Like you said, it doesn't feel like a lot, but it is huge, you know, because yeah. They got their trigger points built up. So they're watching it move towards whatever trigger point they have or containment, you know, line yep. they have and hoping it'll hold on a road or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome, man. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, so when you first got started, did you find it was hard to, like, train your eyes a little bit or like your rhythm, I guess, to patrol for fire? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, what was great about 94 was it was a very busy fire year. And so, and what was great is that year we were dry early. And so, like I said, I didn't know this, but I showed up, had a week of orientation, then a week of fire school. And so fire school was great. Cause I got the nuts and bolts of it. And actually our last day of fire school, they had a prescribed fire get out of containment.
Oh.
And so the guard school people, went up.
Get some hands-on experience.
We got overtime at guard school fighting fire all night.
That was awesome.
And then the next morning, you know, so we worked a night shift between our second to last night day and our final day. And that morning we went into the guard school and they said, you did a good job. You know, you learned what you needed. We don't need to do today. Just go back to your district.
Oh, awesome.
So it was fun. And then that year we started picking up fire in July. And so, you know, by the time I was just barely comfortable, we got, so pretty quickly I figured out, you know, what a dust devil might be, what a water dog might be compared to what a smoke actually looks like. And
yeah. Those water dogs get deceiving.
Oh yeah, they do. And so, so I picked it up pretty quick that summer because at one point I had a lightning storm come through and there's 7-8 fires, new starts, you know, blow me. And dispatch was so busy that basically they're leaning on me, a rookie, to try and help prioritize things because I can see it and nobody else can,
yeah.
You know, like which is closest to private, which is closest to the wilderness, you know, which one's more active. And that was and that kind of pressure made me learn quick.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
quickly in. And what was nice too is it made me realize I enjoy that part of the work too, because it is a weird job in the sense that you have this peace, quiet, you know, for long stretches, and then all it takes is one lightning strike and you could be busy for weeks. And it's a different kind of busyness than you're used to in, you know, in the kind of fire, you know, fighting you've done, but it changes quickly at a lookout.
Well, is it still the mental, what I'm trying to say, like mental work, I guess. Yep. I don't want to say exhaustion, but mental like work that it takes. It's the same, whether it's boots on the ground or on top of the mountain, because you're still got to be on all day long, you know, watching and reporting and working, you know, so it's the same mental aspect too.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, like getting a feel for the country too, probably after you're in an area for a while. I mean, you probably have an idea of kind of where storms are passing through and heavier lighting spots. And
that's what's neat, having been in the North Fork of the Flathead since 98, really to understand. And what's great now too is like when I'm working, say, with a new lookout, like I see something, let's say in Hay Creek, and I know Numa can see that better than I can. So I can call over and, you know, hey, what are you seeing? You know, we can kind of develop, you know, kind of as a group, what we're seeing, how to pass that information on to the fire managers and or firefighters. Yeah. So the lookouts, I mean, that's what's really nice is we work together as a team to kind of filter what we want to get into the management and firefighter folks.
Yeah, totally. The more lookouts, the less blind spots, and the more accurate coordinates you guys can pass on, because you can cross-reference with each other. And we get that in the bidder quite a bit.
Oh, yeah.
Man, you know, like Tanner at Willow and then Ellie at Deer, and they're both in the same area, can't quite get the same vantage point because it's down in a draw, but between the two of them, they can narrow it down really precisely, and then the crew has less hiking to do. I mean, it just works out in everybody's favor to have more lookouts.
Oh, yeah. I mean, triangulation is such a key. I mean, it makes life so much easier, because when you're flying solo on a smoke report, there's a little more pressure. Yeah. When you have two azimuths, I mean, there's times in the Norfolk we'll have three azimuths, and I don't even doubt where it's. I mean, I just run the lines, run the coordinates, and boom, they're going to find it.
Know exactly where it is. Yeah. Oh, it's so awesome, man. Yeah. Because that's tough. Like you've probably been part of that too before, where you're only eyes on it. A crew's out there looking around, and just can't quite find it because it's not putting up enough smoke to even like give it real definitive, I guess, spot.
Exactly.
You get the little puff right in the drift, and then so from like maybe your vantage point or like from the firefighters, there might be a terrain blocking, so you get a puff, and it's more over here, but then the puff comes up over here because that's where you see it first. So trying to narrow that in, you know.
And it's always fun when, you know, you got a crew walking in and they get to your coordinates and they're like, you know, we think we're smelling it, but you know, we're not there. Which direction you head? You know, usually you overshoot. It's my experience. So, you know, like the example I'm thinking of is Kishinen fire from two summers ago. And basically I was like, okay, if you're in the river, if you're in the bottom, it's not on the other side of the drainage, just walk back uphill a ways. And 50 yards later, they were on it.
Dude.
And it's one of those things. So it was a really easy smoke report in the sense that like I could see the whole ground and knew it was very close to the drainage, but I knew which side it was on.
That's cool, man. Yeah.
And that's fun. That's rewarding too, when they're not out there looking for hours.
Yeah, gritting for something. Yeah.
Our old FMO here. And I always say this when I'm training lookouts, I remind them, cause it can feel a little bit of pressure, you know, to get it right. But our old FMO would always say, you know, you lookouts, you try too hard. If we're firefighters, if you get us within a mile or two, we'll get it. You know, that's our job from there.
Yeah, we're happy. Yeah.
And it was nice because it kind of takes a little bit of pressure off. So I always remind other lookouts that when I'm training them. But at the same time, you take a lot of pride if you can get it.
You can nail it.
Oh,
it's so awesome. Yeah. Well, it's a skill, you know, like you walk somebody right into it. It's like, man. Mm-hmm. And then the team, right? Because you're happy and they're super happy. Like, and you get to build this bond.
Yep.
And you, like you said, even though like with the British Columbia stuff, you didn't actually meet them face to face. You might not meet those firefighters maybe at the end of the season, but they're going to remember it. So when they see you, they're like, oh, man, Leaf, dude.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for the help on that one, man. You saved us some miles.
Oh, you know? Yeah. And you're right, because, you know, it is a good team building thing where, you know, that right away, that's they're going to be trusting you for any information you give. If say it turns into an extended attack,
yeah,
they're going to really be trusting what you're saying if you got them in there on a good legal description or, you know, good coordinates.
100%, man.
I mean, I think there was a couple examples of that where one, when we had the Sperry fire, I can't remember the name of that, but we had a, you know, we had a team was managing that, and we had a bunch of resources down near West Glacier, and I had a couple fires show up in the north end of the park, and so they sent a crew up, and I worked with that crew. They were basically their whole 14-day assignment was up, and I was their only contact for that 14 days.
Oh,
and
nice.
we had three fires, and they kind of split up, and then once they got two of the three done, they all grouped up on the bigger one, finished that off, and then they did some structure protection around one of the cabins up there.
Oh, cool.
But I worked with them for 14 days, never met any of them, and then one of them took a job at Spotted Bear, so I actually got to meet one of the people who was on that crew that time. And I mean, we'd talk 6-7 times a day, you know, because basically it was all radio traffic for them through me to get to camp. And the person they had to report to back there, it was really enjoyable.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
It's so cool. And yeah, being part of the team like that, man. And that's, it would be near impossible without you, because then they'd either have to carry a sat phone or have someone else hike up. And then that person isn't working with them anymore. Exactly. So one less team member to go to high point and be the human repeater. So, man, so beneficial to having you. And I didn't even think about it really. I mean, it's crossed my head, but like, coming up here, I didn't really think about like how much beautiful country you have to cover, because not only like we're talking Glacier, and you can see right into Glacier, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Man. And then you got the Bob Marshall Wilderness not far away either.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah. I mean, really, when I was at New Meridge in the park, it's a beautiful lookout. You're right in the mountains, but you're up against them.
Oh.
Like to see the Northern Lights is unique, because you have a peak that's 2,000 feet above you, basically to your north.
A whole block of the view.
Yeah. And so what's nice at Tome is I see the whole stretch of the Livingston Range. Like I see 20 miles into Canada, Alberta, the Continental Divide into Canada, and then all the way down to the southern end of the park and into the Bob.
Oh, man. You have probably had some shows from the Aurora, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Just like feel like it's coming in the cabin in the lookout with it?
And that's what's so fun is, you know, with the lookout group, we'll try and, you know, you always feel bad waking people up, but at the same time, we kind of have an understanding, like, if you're seeing something cool, wake me up.
Yeah, please. Yeah. Uh-huh. I'll be upset if you don't,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, and I was kind of wondering that. I was thinking on the way up, since the Aurora has been so active lately. Me and my wife were at my brother's house. He had kind of like a duplex on his place, and we lived in his basement, and we had a puppy, and my wife let the puppy out, and she's like, I'm seeing something weird. Like, come check this out, because I think it's the Northern Lights. And I was like, and, you know, being low, they're so close to Missoula, I'm like, there's no way, it's light pollution. But I was like, I'll come check it out. And sure enough, it was. And it was, you know, the Aurora can be in so many different forms. This one was almost like a weird little dancing snake coming down the Bitterroot.
Oh,
it
wow.
It was like almost below us. So I was like, oh, man, if a fellow like Leaf were in the lookout tower, I wonder if he's getting it at like eye level sometimes. You know, have you ever had it like low like that?
I don't recall, I guess, but every time is unique for sure. And that's just it. And that's what was fun two nights ago here. And they were outrageous at 6:30. You know, I was getting home from work, and my wife and I, we'd live in the trees, so we could, you know, see it. But we went up, you know, a couple miles up the road to where there's a park that's open and has a view into the park, and it was just carrying on something.
Yeah, it was the reds out of that thing.
Yeah.
Oh. And so early on, like I think my wife had something earlier about seeing someone post like, you know, look for the Northern Lights tonight.
Yeah.
And then she went outside to do something, and it wasn't even completely dark in Stevensville yet. And she was like, holy cow, the Northern Lights are out.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, no way. And, you know, run out there, and just the red coming over the Sapphire Mountains was incredible.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And for us, I mean, the western sky was still kind of dusky. It wasn't dark yet. And that's what was so neat, is seeing it to the north. And then it took a while for the western sky to be lit, because I think it was just too bright still, maybe. Yeah,
because we had the same thing, and then we were getting a little bit more of the greens from the western sky over the Bitterroots, and oh, it's beautiful, man. Oh, I love it. And that's such a special thing about being in the lookout, is to be able to get less light pollution and enjoy a moment and in kind of the silence, you know? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I couldn't imagine waking up. And is it ever bright enough to light up the inside?
Oh, yeah. Oh. Yeah. I mean, the moon shadow is a real thing at a lookout. I mean, where... my example is I can almost read a book by it. If I probably could, if my eyes were better at this point, but I mean the moon shadow, you know, you'll see just like the sun casting the shadow, and it almost can be hard to sleep because it feels like there's a light on or something, but you get used to it too. But the lack of light. I mean, I was working on Schistler Lookout above Moose Creek in the middle, in the Selway Bitterroot.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so above the spot. Selway River, yeah. And there's just no light pollution there. And I saw the northern lights from that lookout one night, too. And I just, to me, it was, I mean, we couldn't get an FM radio station up there. It's so, you know, remote. It was a neat spot. And just like you said, the lack of light pollution, the stars are just outrageous. I mean, it feels like you can touch them because they're just so bright and so vibrant and so there for it. I mean, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, me and Kevin, when I interviewed him last night, we were just talking about that. I hadn't experienced it too much, but we were coming off a fire. We were just assisting the Power Ranger District from Stevensville, and we helped him button it up, small little fire, and we were heading back. We were only on loan for the evening, but the dark was coming, and it's crazy because I just wasn't prepared because it's just over the hill from where I live. Like I wasn't really like thinking like it's about to be like pitch black out here. Mm-hmm. And then the stars, like you said, all of a sudden just like right there. Like, holy cow. And it's air miles, a couple miles from probably my house, you know?
Yeah.
But it's just that big wall of the Bitterroot just blocks out a lot of light pollution and that kind of dark hole back there. And it looks amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Man, just cool experience. Have you had any like weird experiences on the lookout? Like any, like as in, UFOs or just people like waking you up in the middle of the night?
No UFOs, but I have. I mean, you were talking about FFLA conferences. I went to an FFLA conference once where there's a college professor who gave a presentation on UFOs and was trying to get, you know, people's stories because he was like, you're the people who would see something.
That's what I was thinking, yeah.
But on my end, no, I but it's funny because like the Northern Lights to me are always, you're wondering what is, you know, it takes you some time, unless it's like right in your face, but oftentimes it does take some time to figure out, okay, what am I seeing? Is it, you know,
especially not the bright colors and they're kind of doing that more like wavy dancey thing, like little kind of shoots. You're kind of like looking at it for a minute.
Yeah. And really, but in my career, most of the human interactions are always positive. Oh. I've had one weirdo every 10 years or so or something.
Yeah.
But, and then I did have somebody show up middle of the night and basically I woke up with their headlamp through my window, waking me up. But when I jumped out of bed, like, oh my God, it kind of startled them too. So I don't think they were expecting that a human was up there.
Oh, they thought maybe just like an abandoned structure.
That's kind of my guess. By the time it all shook out, I guess that's my interpretation, but basically I was ornery enough that finally when I kind of got to my senses and woke up, I was like, hey man, you know, it was one of those stretches where it was the Moose Fire and I was working 16-hour days. I was exhausted. I mean, cause you talked about the mental exhaustion and at a lookout, that's real. And usually, you know, 10 o'clock, if I'm on fire time, I'm out and sleep and good because I need to be fresh the next day.
Absolutely. And the sun's coming up so early too, right?
And that's the other thing, yeah. And so that time I was like, hey man, just get off the hill, you know, I need to get my sleep.
Yeah,
see you later.
Work.
This is my job.
Yeah.
A lot of wildlife. And what's neat where I'm at is there's a lot of bears.
That's cool.
So, you know, I mean, it's never really anything too dramatic. I've been charged twice, but both those, you know, worked out just fine.
Oh, good.
And but I've had a lot of just neat experiences with wildlife where they're kind of curious about you're curious about them, but it's all safe. And
yeah, black bears or grizz?
Both. You know, they're both are common, I would say. And a lot of times what it is, they'll follow, like as the berries come up to the ridgetop.
Oh, yeah.
That's when I'll have them around. You know, if I see them more like June or July, they're kind of just passing through maybe.
Oh, gotcha.
But oftentimes when the berries are on the ridge, I'll have a group or maybe a family unit like hang around for 3-4 days, work the berries, And it's almost like you get used to, you know, you just give each other space.
Yeah.
And it always works out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you probably can, your hearing's probably a little heightened since there's not a lot of noise. So you probably hear something kind of brushing, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Running through the brush.
And you know, I have my dog with me these days too, and he's a pretty good bear dog. So he sees or smells, and a lot of times he sniffs things out before, you know, like he alerts me when we're coming up on a smell that he's curious about.
That's good, man.
And he handles it well, you know, like he knows he stays by my side, and I, you know, make sure he's leashed up when we know they're around, or if I can tell he's picking something up.
Yeah, smart. Yeah, and because I made that mistake picking berries with my dog a long time ago at Miller Creek, and we'd been up there patrolling the day before, and then I was on my R&R day, so I was like, oh, yeah. You know, middle of the week, my wife's working, me and the dog go up and pick some huckleberries, and we had seen a moose recently, so I wasn't really thinking, and so close to Missoula, I wasn't thinking bear, so I was just head down picking away, and then my dog was on alert, but so I was watching his behavior, my back was to the noise, and I was just picking and putting huckleberries in a jar, and then he got a little bit more stiff, and all of a sudden I started looking, I could see black spot moving, I'm still thinking moose maybe, and I think it was a grizz, and I was like, well, that's probably good enough for us. But the thought, like, dang, I wish I had him on a leash just in case. Because I don't know. I haven't been around a bear with my dog yet, so I don't know how he's going to react. So I was like, we're just down from the truck, though. So like, he's got the spot. He can have these berries. We'll move along.
Yeah.
But it's funny, though, when you're out there enough, though, with wildlife, especially being in the forest, it's like it wasn't worried. I was like, oh, I'll give him a space and go. And then looking back, I was like, man, that was a pretty damn big bear.
Mm-hmm.
But then along the sleep thing, you were talking about some restless nights in the lookout, and I don't think people are aware of that either. Like when a storm comes up, I mean, it's shaking everything with you in it, right?
Yeah. And I mean, oftentimes if it's that breezy, it's hard to sleep, but oftentimes you're dealing with a storm and you're kind of keeping one eye open anyway, waiting on some lightning.
Oh, yeah.
But there are nights where it's so breezy that it's challenging to sleep, and it's as much the, like, I'm on the ground in pretty solid structure, but it's noisy.
Yeah.
And so it's that noise of the wind shaking the wind, you know, because sure, it's a stable structure, but you know, it's old and the windows rattle a bit, the shutters might rattle a bit, you know, if you have a window open, it's gonna, you know, blow things around too. So there's times where you're not getting full sleep, but I think you also get good at sleeping with one eye open a little bit too, because, like, especially if there's a forecast of lightning, like, I try and go to bed earlier than usual so that if and when it does come through, I can be up for a couple hours watching it and then still be fresh the next morning, because... you want to, if you can identify where it's dropping lightning strikes, your work's going to be that much easier the next morning and or the next week, just to know where to be looking.
Are you sketching them down, or are you just kind of taking mental notes as you see them? Or?
Everybody does different things, but yeah. I keep a note. I'm a big back pocket notepad guy, and so I just write the locations down, and then I say... Coal Ridge gets multiple strikes, I just start checking, you know, more check marks for that location.
Oh, gotcha.
And then if I see a tree torch, I will, because, you know, most of the time you see a tree torch, it's not going to turn into a wildfire right then. It might, you know, it's going to burn itself out. It might not show back up it might not be there in the morning, and then you just have to monitor that spot. So when I see a tree torch, I'll actually line it up with a firefinder, write the azimuth down and the location, but not spend so much time doing that I'm missing other strikes that might be happening as well.
Oh, it's kind of just a quick little jot down. Yep. Yeah. And I meant to ask this earlier when you were first starting out on your career, using the firefinder, the Aldade, right? Same, right? Firefinder, Aldade.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Was that a little difficult in the beginning, or is it just like point it and shoot?
Yeah, I would. I mean, I think getting the firefinder is pretty straightforward. I mean, when we train lookouts, I probably spend a half hour to an hour on it, because you only need the basics on it, like how do I get my azimuth in degrees and minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, some of the vertical angle stuff and some of the more advanced stuff, it's not worth going down that rabbit hole when really, especially these days, we're mostly concerned about the azimuth.
Yeah.
Because somebody in an office can pull up your location, put your azimuth on their computer screen and see, get a good sense of where you're looking.
Totally.
But so to me, it's pretty simple and straightforward, but it is an art how once you have your line on the map, how do you get your legal description off of that?
Yeah.
And that takes years.
That's what I was wondering too.
And maybe years isn't fair, but it takes maybe a lot of smoke reports, because some years you might not be busy.
Yeah.
And so the more smoke reports you do, the more legal descriptions you actually do under pressure, it really helps you both get comfortable and get good at getting good accurate coordinates. And the one thing when we were talking earlier that I wanted to say is the other thing that I really make a point of is if I'm not sure about my coordinates, I say so.
Oh yeah.
Because you know, think about it, if you're on a crew and you're walking into that fire trying to initial attack it, and I say, and you're used to me just giving you coordinates and you go.
Just nailing it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, today I might say, hey, you know, I'm not sure, it's somewhere between this ridge and that ridge, so it could be in a 6 mile, you know, somewhere along this line, and that's a 6 mile stretch. So just keep your Scooby senses up as you're coming in there and as you're driving to the trailhead or wherever you're going to start your walk in.
Yeah.
You know, looking both ways, because, you know, I could be off. And that helps them think about how they want to both walk in, approach it, maybe try and get advantage before they leave the vehicle, maybe get an aircraft to help get them in there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. For all the planning and the mental planning too, because then you're like, all right, well, you know, if Leaf isn't so sure, then, you know, at least we're prepared mentally to do a big grid or big walk around, you know, and do a big circle and see what we can find. And, and like you said, get your Scooby senses going, because you start thinking like, all right, I'm going to be, you know, sniffing more often or like paying more attention to the wind or all the things that help you find a fire, you know?
Yeah.
And that's huge.
And what I like too is, I mean, when I first started, it was a little more of a competitive environment, maybe a little bit. And also like the patrol plane, you were kind of competitive with the patrol plane, and these days for me it's like we're all on the same team.
Yeah.
Let's work together. We've had some really good aerial observers here where you know, it's a lot like Reen being the aerial observer down there and how well they communicate and how well he communicates with the lookouts there.
Yeah.
It's you're on the same team, you know. Let's cooperate and get the best information we can as quickly as possible. And
yeah, totally. Yeah, we're all coming out of the same toolbox. Yeah. It's just another tool to help you know, find the fire. And and you know, like you said, the aerial observer thing, it can help. It can help a lot. But you know, it's the constant eyes in the sky, like you, you know, are going to be the a little more definitive mark. But then you get someone else who can maybe zone in if it's behind a blind spot for one of the lookouts, or if they're, you know, just having to be flying over something. You know, it's kind of hard because you're going kind of fast, but you can be flying over something and be able to pick it up, and then you can cross reference it with like your lookout, like you, Leaf, and like, hey, I'm seeing this, but I'm not sure if that's exactly what it is.
Yeah,
and confirm it's not a water dog.
Yeah,
man, those water dogs, man.
Oh yeah, yeah. It. I mean, and it's funny because what I always say when it comes to water dogs is I've watched a lot of water dogs, and I've watched a lot of water dogs for a while trying to be sure. But every time I've seen a fire, I've never been curious if it was or wasn't. So every time I've seen a fire, I know that's a fire. Like right away, it's a fire.
Yeah.
If I'm sitting there watching a water dog trying to figure it out or not.
Chances are it's a water dog.
often, like, because you know, like when you see a fire, but that's an experience thing too. Like I can say that now, but I think early on it, you know, when you're, you know, a few years in, that can be a little more of a struggle because, that confidence and that certainty may or may not be there.
Yeah. And want to prove yourself a little bit too. Like I want to make sure I'm doing it right and calling in everything and doing the best I can. Mm-hmm. And get a little water storm and things hang on the timber line. It's wild. And you're like, man, that is moving like it could be.
Mm-hmm.
But after you get a while, like you said, after you get into it for a while, this last spring we were helping do a stove in the lookout, and you know, one of the fire folks that was helping out kept pointing out a couple of these water dogs, and And I wasn't involved, so I didn't say anything. But I could tell because I've been around long enough. I was like, that's definitely a water dog, But it was fun to see because they were like, man, I think that might be a fire. Thinking, and a lot of lightning had gone through, but I just have stared enough of myself to be able to know at least at that point, like you said, like I have that like feeling of like, oh, that's definitely a fire. Mm-hmm. I just didn't quite have the makeup for what I'd seen.
Yeah.
And you said something too on your doc about kind of getting more of a feel for the world around you a little bit too. I'm trying to remember. It's probably been years since you're on that, but more of a sense, I guess, of like kind of what's happening, like maybe you said intrinsic nature of spotting a fire. I'm trying to think exactly the context of what it was, but it was kind of cool because it was more of like on a feel basis versus just like the tactile senses,
Oh yeah. Yeah. And I think, and that's, it is certainly an art, and that's where I think what's fun is, we can train lookouts and we do I like to think a pretty good job, but to me, you're just giving them the bare bones and it's on the lookout to take it from there and learn the art of it.
Yeah.
And like you said, a lot of it's feel. And I mean, we saw Borg earlier and I remember, like around 2012 or 13, they were the hotshot crew was on a fire they'd posted a lookout every day, but also I was close enough where I could support them as well.
Yeah.
And the one thing we talked about, not necessarily after action review, but one thing we talked about is how, as we communicate on the radio, what you hear in people's voices is a feel thing too. Like you hear somebody stressed, you want to respond with confidence and support. And that's going to make them feel better. Or if, you interact.
Maybe you got a little bit more urgency in that voice. Like,
exactly. Hey. Mm-hmm. And that's another part of it too, is because you're never going to, as a lookout, be looking somebody in the eye. So your radio voice is another aspect of how you can support people. And also, listening to how they're responding. And sometimes for me, it's like backing off. If you can tell, maybe this person, doesn't need too much of this info, I'll just kind of let it sit and let it lay and let them call me if they need some support too. So
man, that's like a good superpower, I guess, kind of not the word I'm looking for, but that's a good quality to have, because like you said, there's so many different things going on, especially like on the boots on the ground side and what you're seeing from your side. Mm-hmm. And to be able to have the feel for the conversation and to be able to use the inflection of your voice to convey how things are going, or to, like you said, simmer things out. Like, no, you guys are in a good spot. I got eyes on, I'm here.
Yeah. And oftentimes in the country I'm working in, that's a lot of it make people reassured, because if you're fighting fire in the trees and you're not seeing out of the canopy much at all, and your head down, and even if you were trying to look at the sky or what the smoke is doing, on another side of the fire, you're not going to see it because you're in the trees. And so that reassurance is a big part of what a lookout can offer. Yeah. There's times where you don't need to provide that, but there's been plenty of times where that kind of reinsurance has been valuable to the crews on the ground.
Oh, it's so good. Yeah. And even like weather-wise too, I've had, lookout save my bacon, where it's like you said, we're timbered up and working and we know there's weather coming, but we can't see it, or we don't know. And then you're like, hey, just heads up, a few miles out, we got a pretty good thunderhead building. Yep. And then, updates as it's coming. And then also like awareness of you, cause the country so well, you'd be like, hey, you guys got to get out now. You're not going to have enough time to hike off. You're going to be in a bad storm if you delay any longer. So, and that confidence, like for me, if I'm in charge on the ground, I'm like, yep, that's what Lee said. We're out, let's go.
Yeah.
And, reassess later after this comes through or whatever, might be the process. But, man, it's invaluable, I would say, for sure. Yeah. And then were you a carpenter before you became to the lookout world?
Well, it's funny. Again, when we were talking to Borg, I almost brought this up. But I'd done some woodworking. But when I was at Mount Henry in 95, it was a really slow fire season. And so our supervisor, me and another lookout and our supervisor, he said, we're going to re-roof Mount Henry. I said, great, sounds cool. Good. Yeah. So, because it was slow year, you know, might as well do something worthwhile. So we went up there and basically shingles flown in, you know, took it on. And he was a little frustrated with me and the other lookouts' lack of experience. Oh. So it took us a little longer.
Was he more old school, like been around a little bit?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because back in the day, just for folks listening, and more, let me know if I'm wrong on this, Leaf. Back in the day, a Forest Service employee, we're all like kind of rangers, but you were kind of a do-it-all employee, right? Like you could kind of build whatever, do whatever. You were a little more capable, I guess, maybe back in the day, right?
Yeah, and it was one of those things in a slow fire season. What are we going to do? Well, let's contribute something. And so, you know, we have time. And so, let's re-roof that lookout. It needs it. But I really enjoyed the process and the work. And so I learned a lot. And I mean, he was both impatient and patient, you know, because we needed to learn so we could do it properly. And it's the first lookout I re-roofed. And
very cool.
I mean, what's neat is now, same thing. Like when I'm re-roofing a lookout, I'll often say to the crew that's supporting me is, okay, do you want to learn? Like, how many of you want to do this step or that step? What do you want to, you know, do you want to learn this, or are you just here to support me and you don't care? And then, you know, just stay out of my way kind of, you know, so you always try and get that going. But
that's a great way to save time too. Cause then you know, if you're wasting anyone's time or if people aren't getting opportunity or like, I'd love to ask Leif something Leif something, but if he's too busy, you know, they don't want to slow you down either. Right.
Yeah. And so, and I guess backtracking on that re-roof story, the way it worked out was then that fall, you know, once, you know, I worked in the fall, into like October, November on the crew. Cause once I was done with the lookout, I'd go down and work on the crew and help with fall burning and stuff like that. And when I got back home, I needed work. It was my first winter out of college. And I said, boy, I want to, you know, that was a good experience. I want to learn more.
Yeah.
And fortunately, I got in with a really good, crew here in the Flathead. And the contractor was awesome. He said, okay, you're going to be here from November to April. I said, yep. And he said, okay, we'll take you. And it was a teaching crew where we learned as we went. They just didn't expect me to work a shovel or a broom, which I did a lot of.
Yeah.
But if you were installing siding or decking or framing a deck, they made sure you were doing it right because they didn't want, you know, anything other than a high quality product.
Yeah.
And that contractor, basically I'd say, okay, April 15th this year. And then he'd say, okay, see you in the fall. And so I'd come back after fire season and fall burning and jump in with a crew. And I did that for quite a few years. And that's really what taught me. And the both the contractor, the foreman, and the whole crew, they were awesome to work with and still are friends, you know, today.
That's cool, man. Yeah. Yeah, and the skill to have, because the reason why I was asking that is because what I understand, like, your kind of role as a lookout too now is the upkeep of the structure. We kind of touched on it earlier, but like, I wanted to talk about that a little bit more. Like, every year you're going on to keep it standing, I guess, kind of in the sense, right?
Oh, yeah. And that's where, I mean, basically, I guess on specifically on our district, but generally on the Flathead, you know, I probably get to most of our lookouts every season.
Oh, really?
And just take a look. And then certainly the ones we staff, both through the volunteer program and our district, you know, I go to a few times a year to both prepare for the season, shut her down for the season. And then in the midst of that too, I also go to other locations to support their efforts to keep their lookouts, especially their staff lookouts, operable and functional and in good shape. And so, yeah, that's become a big part of my job and my work, which for me, what I like is it just gives me more lookout time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, 100%. It's not that I don't enjoy a lot of the stuff the crew does and being a part of the fire crew, especially as I've aged. I mean, it's a skill I have. And so it gives me that much more time on the trail, in the backcountry, up at lookouts.
Very cool.
Yeah. And so, like, this year, actually, last couple summers, I've supported the Kootenai National Forest with a few of their lookouts and re-roofed a few of theirs, done a bunch of other work on new floor, you know,
new glass, a bunch of stuff like that on some of their lookouts this past summer.
Oh, very cool. Yeah. Do you have the shop here? Or do you have to go all the way down to Missoula for some of the stuff? Like,
no. So because, I mean, that's where it's goofy, is because I'm a carpenter, house builder in my other job, I have a shop at home.
Oh, nice.
And so in my sense, it's so much easier for me because I have all my stuff, is I just work out of my shop.
Awesome.
And like this winter, I'll rebuild, I'll do a few doors, a few windows, that kind of stuff in my shop.
That's what's kind of wondering, just from peeking around, it just didn't look like you have the room over here.
Nope.
Or the tools.
And that's just it. We do have a bit of a shop at the warehouse, but we have a, what's nice is we have an agreement that the ranger signs every year that allows me to use my shop, personal shop as a employee. And that also kind of gives me that coverage when I'm working on government time to be in my shop, do that.
Yeah.
And it's so much easier because then what I don't have to do, like when I went to the Kootenai, is I load all my tools, and I'm fine, you know, use my personal tools on a government job. But I load all the stuff I need into my truck, and I don't want to have to come here and then change it into a government truck. So I just, you know, they give me mileage.
Awesome.
And just, it makes it so much easier.
Yeah, it makes sense. That sounds like the right way to do it. Yeah. For sure, man.
And that's, I mean, a lot of what works well when I go other places, basically all I need is a job code.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just like being on a fire in some respects. I mean, my fire time anymore is working on lookouts.
Oh, cool.
And that's where a lot of times the understanding is, because I'm here working 80 hours a pay period, sometimes I can squeeze in 6 days of maintenance and my off days, and I might be, you know, on the Kootenai on overtime doing that. But at the same time, as a GS5 seasonal, even if I'm on overtime, it's still a pretty fair rate for the work that I'm doing.
Really, I would say you're donating a little bit there. Oh, yeah. You know, with your skills.
I make a little more as in my, you know, when I'm wearing the tool bags and, you know,
private contractor. Yeah, for sure, man. And I think that's the missed stuff, see, that people don't really see if they're at the top levels or outside of the agency, like someone like you bringing that skill level for a very discounted rate, which is amazing. Yeah. And man, the cool thing is just like the structure you get to work on, because I mean, there's a few homes probably, but you know, that would have like a cedar shingles, but most people are pushed towards tin because of fire safety and longevity. So getting a chance to be able to work on some stuff like that.
Oh yeah.
And I imagine, I guess, is that like when you go to do your assessments, is it kind of like roof shutters, like making sure it's dried in, and then like top down kind of like
that?
Oh
yeah. I mean, absolutely. I mean, you're trying to keep the weather out, and you're right. So roof shutters, glass, siding, I mean, all that. But oftentimes, I mean, what's unique is every lookout, I mean, even though they're standardized structures for the most part, everyone is a little unique because it has a different need.
Yeah.
And so that's part of the fun. And then because in my my private work, I have to deal with estimating and planning. And so that's where I'm pretty comfortable coming up with a number. This is how we can do it. This is the steps to do it in.
Yeah.
And especially like if it involves flights and flight time, you can get weights together. And so it's a part of it that part is also enjoyable in the sense of, and that's where the backcountry ones I even like better than, I mean, drive ups are, I'm happy to work on drive ups, but they're just a little less fun in it because the challenge isn't there. Cause you can, in theory, call down to the office and say, I need this.
Yeah,
and they can have it to you in a half day or the next day. Where if you're in the middle of the Sowe Bitter Wilderness on a lookout and you didn't bring something, it's not coming.
No.
And you're going to have to figure it out.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah. Get the problem-solving skills really in motion there. Get those juices flowing.
Yeah. Well, and that's where I've learned, that's why you plan.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It makes you a great planner probably, huh?
Yeah. And it's... good planning makes everything go way better.
Yeah. Saves so much headaches, so many headaches. Yeah. And then also I was wondering, what do you have a favorite style lookout or just kind of whatever one you're in?
Well, I like the old school. I mean, the R6 flat top is nice because of the added square footage.
Yeah. Is that what Blue Mountain is?
Blue Mountain's weird in the sense, I don't even remember because of the
the angled glass, and it'd be like Deer Mountain.
Oh, Deer Mountain.
Or yeah. Willow, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, they're both flat tops.
The flat top, and it's 16 by 16 rather by 14. And that 2 feet makes a big difference inside.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I like the old school, you know, the cupola ones are cool. I wouldn't want to staff a cupola one because it'd be awkward to be that up down.
There, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so, but yeah, the old school L4s are fun. And I mean, that's where I've worked on a lot of, I mean, I think, you know, this summer when I was re-roofing that one on the Kootenai, the crew was asking me, you know, and I think that was like number 20 something as far as re-roofing.
Oh, really?
And so the cedar shingles are so much more fun than the flat top roofs.
Yeah.
And it just takes a little more craftsmanship to pull that off.
Yeah, totally. Because it's similar to a standard shingle, right? With the spacing, you know, isn't
yep.
it?
Yeah.
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 And then, mm-hmm. and you're splitting them by hand to make the sizing, right?
No, you don't. I mean, anymore, it just, they come.
Oh,
bundled and ready to go. And
oh,
you
cool.
just, yeah, but you're right. Spacing. And then especially on a hip, you know, you're cutting the angles. And then it depends if you're, you know, what, how you're doing the ridge or the hips, you know, that can take some artistry too. So
yeah, I bet. Yeah. Cause you got to make sure that, yep. that that's all dried and secure. Cause that's where the wind's going to be hitting a little harder too, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
On that ridge.
Yeah.
And what's the lifespan on a fresh cedar roof?
Well, it's funny. All of the ones I have completed are still doing good.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The Mount Henry one that I did in 94, or 95, excuse me. That one it might be getting there.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it might be getting there. But
that's, I mean, a long time.
It seems to me like 30, 40, 50 years. I re-roofed Baldy and the Yak 2 summers ago. And those shingles, it was impressive how they were worn so thin that they were almost gone. And it had to be 50, 60 years just on the condition of those shingles. And the roof was still performing.
Yeah.
It just was probably past due by the time I was there.
That's impressive because I'm not really sure, but it feels like, what do you get, like 10 years out of an asphalt roof, like asphalt shingles?
Oh, no, most of those are going to be 25, 30-year warranty.
Like,
and so you might get more.
Oh, gotcha.
I think the places that have like weird hail storms are the ones that they're always ripping them off, and it's an insurance thing then.
Oh, but that's why it looks
mean,
like it's...
The house I'm building now, you know, it's a 30-year warranty shingle.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's really good. So imagine, because you probably tore a few roofs off before, and I've got a little experience where you have layers of shingles. So, I mean, that could be like quite an old house, but it's got that many, you know, that many shingle layers, you know?
Yeah.
That's kind of the old school way to do it, just slap a new one on.
Oh, yeah, right over top.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Man, and I guess it worked. You know, most of the places I worked on were still didn't have any water damage. They were just looking for a new roof.
Oh, yeah.
Want to go all the way down to the OSB, right? Sheeting?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Plywood or OSB. Yeah.
Plywood or OSB, yeah.
And I even ran into a lookout where they did that, where basically we had to take off 2 layers. And at that point, you know, the State Historic Preservation Office got in the mix. And so they told us which way we had to replace it, so it was a little it got a little awkward in the sense like it wasn't the best option for that particular structure, but
it was like
it was historic.
Yeah,
and that's so time. And that's fine, and really that's, I mean, a big part of it is making sure that we're doing things to historic standards, because all these lookouts are over 50 years old other than a couple.
Yeah,
so really we have to make sure to any work restore them as they were.
Totally.
Which is, it's not that challenging, but it's an important part of it.
It is, because once it gets a, you know, like a hole in the roof or something, and starts getting some damage, and man, they crumble quick.
Yep.
And that's where I feel like I'm in a rush right now, because the time period we're in, you know, like some of these lookouts, like you're saying, probably from the 20s, 30s, 40s, and on. Not much left of them. So I'm trying to, I feel like I'm in this race to go hike to every lookout that I know about to go visit and just see it with my own eyes and take photos and stuff, you know?
Especially because there are some out there that are, you know, not being taken. And basically we redid the Coleridge Cabin, which was, like I said, a 1928 lookout, grain style. And but they built a L4 on legs in 39 to basically make a permanent lookout building that was higher standard L4. And by the 90s, the cab was hanging off the side. Oh. And so over the years, it was, I mean, it was interesting to watch how the whole site crumbled over the next 10 to 15 years.
Dang.
There were times where you didn't want to be up there on a windy day and close to it because you just felt like that thing could drop on you at any point.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it was hanging by the lightning protection, basically, off the side for a few years.
Jeez, just copper wires holding it up.
Yep.
Man.
And then the next, you know, 1 year I came and it was incredible. It's a good example of how strong a hip roof is, but the roof was intact and on the ground upside down.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that, yeah.
Yeah, so you're basically walking on the ceiling.
That's wild.
Yeah.
Yeah, and to be able to take that impact, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was poking my head in Blue Nose Lookout because I was trying to collaborate with the Clear Nez on Clearwire Nez Perce National Forest. I think Matt out of Salmon, I think was his name. But good guy. We're trying to figure out how to coordinate, like, with, I was helping work with the Job Corps and then work with the Bitterroot, and it's right on the border, so we're trying to figure out how to save that one. It's still kind of in the works. It just, with all the stuff going on lately, it's been on the back burner. But, that one took a bunch of pictures for Jack Poppin inside, and, some of the glasses broke out. So it's definitely needing some TLC sooner than later. But that one's super cool. Good. Like you said, though, the interior of that roof, I mean, it looked great. I was I poked my head into the little crawl space. Like, all right.
Good.
It'll survive a little longer.
Is that the one that has like a weird like drive-in?
Like a little carport almost? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's super cool.
I've heard about that. I've never been to that one. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was really cool. And Reen said there was another one on like Bear. It was not too far away. Like, you could see each other.
Okay.
And I think the 2000 or the Mustang fire might have got it, which is unfortunate.
Okay. Yeah.
But yeah, Blue Nose is still there. And it's got the big doors. And it's really cool. And then, what's it called? Oriana, I think is the name.
Okay.
That's how I pronounce it. It might be somewhere else, but it's in rough shape and it's just down the way, too. Yeah. So those are two of the projects that I was trying to get moving, which is still in the works. Yep. It's just, you know, it goes kind of slow, just identifying. Yep. Issues and then kind of going from there.
Yeah. And that's just it. I mean, there's times where you have time and there's times where you don't. And hopefully you can keep them moving to where they get some care.
Totally.
You know, before it's too late.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's just such a great, I don't know, getaway for folks, right? Like even excuse for me to go on a hike is to go explore, to find a lookout that I know is there because I've seen on a map or you've told me about it, or whatever it might be, Irene, you know, and then, or Kat and Billy are really good at, you know, going out and hiking, finding some old spots or just like a rental, like, Medicine Point Lookout, where me and my wife stayed years ago. It's like just such a good retreat to the middle of nowhere on top of a mountain and get to experience something that you get to experience all the time, you know?
Yeah. And I think the rental program has been really a big success for the Forest Service, because like you said, so many people get to experience that.
Yeah.
And it obviously, you know, the big complaint is how hard it is to reserve them.
It is. Yeah.
But at the same time, the people that get them, it's a neat experience.
Yeah. It's a good problem to have. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And except, I mean, like a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, these middle of the week, like one night trips, because they're so popular, people are willing to go in the middle of the week because that's the only time you can get it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it just shows you how special they are.
Yeah.
Man, it's a special job, and man, it takes a special human. I appreciate you so much, Leif. And I don't want to cut you short, but I also don't want to keep you all night because we kind of got a late start.
Okay.
I feel like we're just scratching the surface here, my friend.
All right. Yeah.
Am I leaving anything on the table? You got anything you want to add?
I can't. No, I once start talking, I kind of lose track of where I'm at, so I'm hoping we've stayed on track anyway.
Oh, yeah, no, totally, man. This for folks listening, it's the first time me and Leif have ever met each other, and it's been definitely, I've been wanting to, you know, at least meet you even for the longest time, because I was aware of you for a long time, and then you left that awesome note I appreciate so much on our wife's or my truck, or me and my wife's truck, and she happened to be driving it, and she's like, and she even knew who you were.
Oh, boy.
And she's like, I was looking, I think I might have saw him, but you know, I think you were on your way in and they were on their way out, needing my wife and kiddos. And then, but it was like at the time where like things were starting to get a little challenging. I think I just gotten a hold of this thing and, you know, just like a little bit of a money pit for this project going, right? You know, because this thing was a shed before I got a hold of it. So like just the kind words you had in your note was like really encouraging, man. Yeah. So I appreciate that a lot.
Well, and I appreciate the work you're doing. It's I enjoy listening.
Oh, thanks, man. I'm trying to do all right job, you know, hopefully getting better every time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, like I said, man, we'll have to do a follow up. But Leif, thanks so much for coming on, man. I appreciate your time.
Oh, you bet. Thank you, Luke.
Yeah. And thanks for tuning in, folks. All right.